The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
On today's show, we're honored to have with us Cindy Blackstock. She's a member of the Order of Canada and from Gitxsan Nation in northern British Columbia, and she's launched a decades-long battle against the federal government's unequal funding for children who are Indigenous. She argued and won at the Human Rights Tribunal a ruling that Canada is discriminating against those children and ordering equal funding. This week marked the five-year anniversary since that landmark ruling. Since then, she's had to go to court again and again to have compliance orders against Canada, which she has won. And in December 22nd, the federal government filed an order to overturn all of those rulings, arguing that the Human Rights Tribunal did not have jurisdiction in the matter and that it could not be ordered to fund non-status Indigenous children the same as other Indigenous Indian status children. Blackstock is executive director of the First Nations Children and Family Caring Society and a professor of social work at McGill University. Hi, Cindy.
So delighted to be here, David.
Welcome to The Pulse on CFRO, Cindy. What an honor to have you here. And happy 2021. We haven't talked to you yet this year, so I hope that it's a pattern and a good year for you.
Me too, and for First Nations kids. I'm hoping that this is finally going to be the end of the discrimination they faced by the Canadian government for so long.
Yeah, what is the status of all of your legal efforts to have the government live up to its commitment to these kids? They've had so many rulings against them over and over again, and it doesn't seem to be budging that dial. You're still in court.
We're still in court, but we have budged the dial a bit. And let me just explain to your listeners what that's all about. Of course, the federal government funds public services on reserve, whereas the provinces do for everyone else. And as you know, David, back to Confederation, the feds have given First Nations kids far fewer services. And even when they do fund those services, they're to a lesser standard. So back in 2007, we, along with the Assembly of First Nations, filed a human rights case against Canada. We didn't get the decision until 2016. So that's, 9 years later. But the decision substantiated the racial discrimination by the Canadian government and ordered them to stop.
And that was, for our listeners' reminder, that was the original case back in 07. You found out, I think about 5 years into that they were spying on you, right?
Yes, I did. And that was just, during the history of the actual hearing of the case, Canada did everything it possibly could to not have the facts presented to the Canadian public or to the courts. They wanted to throw it out on technical issues. And when that didn't work, they tried to discredit me by doing this kind of surveillance activity. But unfortunately for them, I live a pretty boring life and they never found anything.
Did they find out about your obsession with cheesies?
Oh, yes. I am guilty of that. I do have an obsession with Hawkins cheesies. I love Hawkins cheesies and bath bombs.
No, I'm not spying on you. I heard about it on the CBC in your great interview you did in the last year.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely legit. I admit it. So the decision found the Canadian government racially discriminating, and Canada said it would comply, but then it didn't. And so now we're in non-compliance motions. But the good news is, because of the ongoing litigation, First Nations kids in child welfare are now getting double the budget that they were before the litigation, before the decision. And over 777,000 services have gone out to First Nations kids under Jordan's principle.
Okay. Are we talking healthcare, education? Like, what kind of services in specific?
Jordan's principle is about ensuring First Nations kids can access public services free of discrimination because, they were often denied things like access to special education supports that other kids would take for granted, or basic healthcare things like having hospital beds so that they could hospice at home without going into respiratory distress. Those are things that the Canadian government denied in the past that are now available to kids. Or kids with cystic fibrosis can get percussion vests, or children with diabetes can get insulin pumps. That kind of stuff.
Yeah. We just actually interviewed Alanis Abomsuma about her new film on Jordan Anderson, The Messenger, and it was just so powerful to actually hear his family and to remember his story. Jordan River Anderson, of course, was the subject of this sort of interjurisdictional fight between Manitoba and the federal government and ended up not getting the care to keep him alive.
Yeah, that's right. And the reason he didn't get the care that was because he was First Nations. If he was any other child in Canada, he would have gotten that care. And that's what that discrimination looks like, right? It's imagine yourself as a parent and you have a child in need and you're told no because of their race, right? Like that literally is the lived reality of First Nations parents across this country, even today, even after all these orders, there's still more to do.
Because you said that they have doubled the amount of funding, but it still falls short of what non-Indigenous Canadians get off reserve.
Absolutely, it falls short. And, you know, we can see some stark examples of that. It doesn't take a rocket scientist. Like, I'm even thinking about the water crisis, right? You might remember just before the Christmas season of last year, 2020, a child from a Northern Ontario First Nation actually took to YouTube because their community was on a boil water advisory for 25 years. And then the water was so toxic that they couldn't drink it anymore. So they had to be relocated to Thunder Bay. And this little kid had never lived in a community where they didn't have a boil water advisory, where you could drink from the tap. So the child sits up on, has a YouTube video where they feel it's necessary to tell the Prime Minister of Canada, look, we're not animals, we're human beings. That's what it feels like when you're told no because of who you are, to receive basic public services that everybody else takes for granted.
So this has taken almost 15 years of your life now. I mean, more because you've done this work longer, but in this legal case, this one legal battle, do you think that going this legal strategy has paid off in the sense that this could become a long-term requirement of the government? It just seems to really target this one very systemic attitude. Like, we're talking about healthcare racism a lot in our province and individual emergency room attitudes. This is the systemic side of that, right? This is like the... This can't be changed just by an education course.
No, it can't. And it really, that's where the public really has a big role to play. I know when we see these things on TV about the racism in hospitals and stuff, it can feel pretty overwhelming. But we actually are the ones who contain the tide of this. By letting our elected officials know, if they discriminate by race against or any other factor, that gender, whatever, they're not going to get our vote, regardless of what political party they're in. If we did that and we kept it up, this would stop. It would stop for First Nations children. It would stop for people going in for health care because the discrimination would no longer go unnoticed by those who have a position to toss politicians out of power who aren't prepared to deal with it. So it's really key that we get on our email or our Skype call or whatever we can do COVID safe with our members of the legislature and parliament and say, stop it. We're not going to discriminate in our name.
Do you think the time that you've put into this has made it worth it? What, tell us about like the strategy itself in terms of going this legal route, because it's a lot of your time, right?
Right.
And the energy.
Yeah. But even if I think about that, I think it's important for people to know that wasn't our first card we played off the deck. We'd actually worked for 10 years before that with Canada, documenting the inequalities and coming up with evidence-informed solutions by economists and others. And it was only when Canada didn't implement that that we returned to litigation. So I think litigation has been the only thing that has resulted in change in the Canadian government. We have legal orders. They're not decisions that Canada can just ignore. They have to implement them or they can be found in contempt. The second thing that's happened, though, is as caring Canadians have become more aware of these inequalities, and even those who are skeptical, like, you know, go check out the Auditor General's reports. Go check out the Parliamentary Budget Officer's reports. You can go check out the tribunal's rulings. You can see independent decision makers one after another validating these inequalities. People have become, you know, kind of really aware about it, and they want it to stop. And children have been such a big part of this because they see the unfairness and they don't make any excuses for it. So they themselves, in peaceful and respectful ways, have been demanding change because they want to grow up in a Canada where First Nations kids matter and where they don't have to fight for the during their childhoods for the basic services every other kid takes for granted.
This sounds like such an incredible opportunity for kids, whether they're Indigenous or not, to get engaged too. Tell us some stories about how you're engaging like families and kids in this campaign.
Yeah, well, we have a wonderful bear named Spirit Bear, And he's he's a teddy bear, and he represents First Nations and all other children who stood up for justice during a long history of this case. And if you go online, you're going to find all kinds of free activities that you can do with Spirit Bear to implement the TRC's calls to action, even from home. And one of the fun things we have coming up is called Have a Heart Day. So Have a Heart Day actually is where children of all diversities write letters to their elected officials so that First Nations kids can grow up safely in their families, get a good education, be healthy, and proud of who they are. And they can do it in drawings or poems or whatever. But one of the things we're doing for COVID this year is instead of having kids gather with their letters, which we can't do for safety reasons, we're asking kids to build snow bears in the look like Spirit Bear, and then to have the bear hold their sign and to work with an adult to put that on Spirit Bear's Twitter feed, which is @SpiritBear. You can find out all about it there. So we have these free positive activities for children to learn along with their families and actually help make a difference.
Now, I wanted to turn to child welfare issues. We've been talking about birth alerts all week on our program because the BC government turns out to have learned from its own lawyers that alerting social workers to First Nations women having children before birth could actually be unconstitutional, and the government continued doing it for months. Other provinces keep this up. What's your reaction to hearing those kinds of stories about that, you know, a very obvious example of how the system is kind of turned against Indigenous women?
Well, I think it's another example like the tribunal. Like, these are laws that you and I would have to follow, David, right? If we didn't comply with the law, we would find ourselves with orange jumpsuits on pretty soon, right? But the government will regularly breach the law, and it feels like it operates above the law and that it can break the law. It can ignore this tribunal decisions. It can ignore the Constitution as long as it serves their interests. And that's why it is so important that we as citizens stand up and tell the government and anybody else who happens to be in the legislature, the other parties, that we expect them to respect human rights for everybody, respect the legal decisions, and to not perpetrate racism for any reason against any group of people, particularly First Nations folks. A word about birth alerts is that the research shows there's not enough evidence to show they work or don't work. So they shouldn't be used at this time until there's evidence that they work. And they shouldn't be used in a way that breaches the law for First Nations families. So that's just totally unfair.
What's the impact on those families? I mean, we're talking, you do First Nations, you know, families and children caring society, and here's an example of a newborn baby being removed from its family. Nothing has happened to it yet.
Right. And I think it's really important we understand one thing, is none of us want kids to be unsafe. And there are rare circumstances where babies even have to be removed from their family. But I underline the word rare. In most cases, you can provide supports to families for them to address the issues that may be putting their children at risk. And that requires us to think clearly about, okay, so you got this parent group, and there are some challenges they're facing, maybe things like addictions, et cetera. But what do you have control over and can fix on their own with services? And what are the risks that are being the government policies, the government decisions that are piling up on these families in ways that put them in the situation where they're at risk? So, for example, what I'm talking about is if you're a First Nations person and you're living in one of those communities without any water and without power, then it's going to be a lot harder for you to parent, right? Or if you're a multi-generational survivor of residential schools and you've never had the services to process that trauma, that's going to continue to ripple across many generations. And so you need access to those things.
One of the things that this whole birth alerts scandal, which we know has been going on for years, has brought up now is a lot of First Nations are saying, we want to join the very few who have agreements to take care of their own child welfare. And a lot of them are saying, you know, okay, if a family needs support raising the kid or can't raise the kid, it shouldn't be taken away from its extended family or its community or its nation. And that's what's too often happening with child welfare, is the complete removal from the nation. What's going on with Indigenous control over child welfare? I know that's been such a rallying cry in the last few years.
Well, actually, not just the last few years. I was part of writing a report where that was a recommendation to the federal government 21 years ago.
Wow.
So this has been on the books for a long period of time. I need to just emphasize one critical thing. Governments, including the federal government, are often very keen at offloading very expensive programs onto First Nations to avoid having to pay for it anymore. They will offload these programs with insufficient funding and then basically wash their hands of it. And that's my worry with this. When Canada drafted that act that allows for the affirmation of First Nations laws, it did so in a way that made sure that it had no clear positive obligation to fund any of this. And it wrote that at the same time when it was fighting against the implementation of the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal orders that were pushing the Canadian government to move towards equity in child and family services. That's where we had the doubling of the budget. So what we need to make sure is that there's affirmation of First Nations jurisdiction and that Canada and British Columbia accept their responsibilities to ensure that those laws are adequately funded so that those children, those families, and those communities get equitable benefit out of those laws.
You mentioned that legislation relating to child welfare and Indigenous control. Is that Bill C-92?
Bill C-92, yeah.
One of the things we saw here in BC is that the government did come into agreements with Aboriginal delegated agencies, but they're just enforcing the same child welfare laws and they're underfunded. And we've seen over and over a number of scandals, and that's not what people see as Indigenous control, especially not the funding.
Well, I think that I just nuance this a bit. There's actually some really great First Nations agencies in British Columbia. And they have, with the equitable funding that is starting to be provided since 2018, made a huge gains forward in terms of providing culturally based care. And what we know from the national data is that First Nations children cared for by agencies are far less likely to be removed and separated from their families than First Nations kids served by provinces or territories.
Interesting.
So that's important for us to know. I absolutely get that there are areas where there's been some concerns in BC and other areas about agency practice, and those need to be dealt with. But I'm just saying, in a broad brush, there has been a lot of good work there. If you take what the agencies need to succeed is, one is they need to have the legislation informed by what the needs of the children are, and it ought to be culturally based. Number two, they need substantively equal funding, and that's what the tribunal has ordered Canada to pay. The other thing that needs to happen is you can take over child welfare even under those two conditions. But if Canada continues to underfund every other public service, like education, early childhood, addictions, housing, water, it's going to be very hard for that child welfare agency to have any effect. Because the key drivers for First Nations kids going into care are poverty, poor housing, caregiver substance misuse related to mental health issues that are multi-generational from residential schools. So you need to get at those drivers, which are located often in the underfunding of the federal government and those other services, in order to make a meaningful difference for kids.
You have connections to the territories out on the West Coast here. And I'm wondering, when you were growing up, did you ever imagine you'd be where you are today, fighting the Canadian government for decades and sticking with this for so long?
No. My first job, David, when I was 4 years old, I'm from BC, right? I grew up in a bush in northern BC. And my first job when I was 4 years old was picking pine cones for reforestation. I put them in a gunny sack.
I want that job.
And I believe in the goodness of people. So I always believed, and this was naive on my part, that if we work with experts and we documented the inequalities and provided Canada with evidence about how they could fix it, and what the positive impacts would be on children that they do it. But what I've come to realize now after 40 years of doing this is that the most obvious things that government should do to fix, like, for example, like the civil rights movement, right, where you had black people not being able to go into a bus depot, like that's ridiculous, right? That should be an of course thing, fix it, right? Or you have First Nations kids, in this case, receiving less public services because of their race.
How about the water issue? Fixable.
Yeah. And what I find is it's exactly those issues that are the hardest to fix because they've been so normalized within the public service that they cannot grapple with it. That is the curse of the systemic discrimination. And that's why we, the public, need to make sure that we push the governments to change, because government doesn't create change, it responds to change, sometimes with legal orders, and most effectively when the public says, we've had enough change.
Who most influenced you as a pinecone-picking Gitsan kid in Northern BC to have the values that you do the kind of fight that you're doing, do you think?
Well, I really credit my mom and my family members for that, right? Especially because I grew up in a bush and weren't a lot of other people around, right? But also, you know, throughout my working career, I have been so blessed to be supported and directed by some amazing people like Joan Glode of the Mi'kmaq Nation, LG Flat from Manitoba, Raymond Shingoose, Mary T.G. there out of D.C. and Warner Adam. There's so many, Deb Foxcroft, so many people I could pull out of and say that they helped me understand this in a way and to try to govern my own behavior in a way that I try to bring, try to match the dignity of these children and these families and to try to contribute to the long legacy and long history of many, many people who came before me who tried to move the dial for First Nations kids and actually created a foundation that people like me could stand on.
Thank you so much for your time. I really wish, Cindy, that 2021 is full of lots of uptake on your teddy bear campaign and also lots of Hawk and Cheesies for yourself.
Well, thank you. That would be pretty good, you know? I could have like a cheesy kind of confetti thing, right? That's happening for next New Year.
One day, yes. Well, take good care. Stay in good health during this difficult time. And thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. And also, I would just want to give a shout out to Ellen Nisobonso, and everyone should watch that film.
It's a beautiful film. Okay, take good care. Bye-bye. And that was Cindy Blackstock. She's the founder and head of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. She's Gitsan from Northern BC and is also a professor at the School of Social Work at McGill University. She can be found on the website fncaringsociety.com or on Twitter at Caring Society. We reached her in Ottawa.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.